From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Alex Gibney is a very prolific documentarian, but this year was crazy even by his standards. He was in the middle of making his two-part HBO series, Agents of Chaos, about Russian interference in U.S. politics, when he dived into another film about the Trump administration's pandemic response. And he was determined to have that one ready to go before the election.
It was insane, absolutely insane for me to even consider it. But, you know, I lost a friend to COVID. Another friend of mine, you know, was on a ventilator for 2 weeks. And I was just gobsmacked by the completely incompetent federal response to the pandemic. And I just thought something needs to be done.
Gibney talks about putting together his coronavirus documentary amidst a chaotic news cycle, and how he got high-level government insiders to talk about Russian interference for his other project, Agents of Chaos. But first on the news banter, Disney reorganizes and Hollywood is confused. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. How are you, Matt?
Doing okay. How are you?
I am okay. Disney. Is Disney okay? That is my question right now. We're seeing a lot of reorganization in Hollywood, and these are as part of layoffs, as part of pandemic, as part of accelerating, above all, to the streaming model. We've talked about this a lot. So the latest to announce something is Disney. They announced something that I do not understand, but I am not alone. They said that Bob Chapek, who came from the theme parks and who is now CEO after, I will note, the hasty resignation of Bob Iger from that job as the pandemic was getting underway, Bob Chapek has tapped someone named Karim Daniel, formerly president of Consumer Products, Games, and Publishing, to run a new division. The new division is called Media and Entertainment Distribution, and it is going to figure out where content goes. And reporting to this will be all of the film studios and TV studios and sports. All of these divisions will produce content, and somehow that will be sorted out with Karim Daniel, a person who has not made any content, no film, no TV show ever. You know, Hollywood changes and Hollywood stays the same. And I've often said on the show how slowly, slowly, Netflix has become more and more like an old school Hollywood institution. And I am not the only one to make that observation. They come in, we're from the digital world, we're reinventing the wheel. Their reinvention of the wheel went really well. And then they sort of hit a certain point of maturity and they start becoming more and more studio-like, traditional. They have a network exec now running their TV programming. They have a film exec running their movies. So slowly, slowly, these things change. However, Disney has the old model, and they are trying to pivot to be more like Netflix. I mean, the whole process is reversing itself. The problem is, I think, Matt, you know, and Disney's talking a lot about how this is a meaningful thing, and Wall Street got excited, and the stock went up, and, oh, they're pivoting to streaming, they're accelerating it. But the people who make content in Hollywood have a way of clinging to the way things are done. They just resist change. And you can come in and throw everybody out, but then to me, you're trying an experiment that's never been conducted before of taking a legacy institution and trying to say, we're doing something completely new with players who have never made anything.
Yeah, this is the old adage. Netflix is trying to become Disney before Disney becomes Netflix. And this is a move of Disney towards becoming Netflix. At least that's how they're positioning it, and that's why the stock went up. But the real question here, and I think there's a lot of disagreement, is what this actually means in a practical sense. Because you could make the argument that an executive coming in to a top distribution job with no experience in content actually emboldens all of these executives at Disney whose experience is in content. People like Peter Rice and the television group, people like Alan Horn and his team in the film group. These are people with decades of experience in content, and now they're going to be arguably left to do their thing, make what they want to make, and then there's this other executive that will figure out the best place to put it. Or you make the other argument, which some have, that this is Disney saying, you know what, all of these different fiefdoms that we've had with all these random cable channels like Freeform and Disney Channel and ESPN 5, all of these things are eventually going away. It's all about creating a one-stop shop Disney Plus streaming service that can actually compete with Netflix and having one executive looking at the entire kingdom and saying, this is where it should go.
You can't imagine that that's possible. I mean, Kevin Feige runs Marvel. Theoretically, according to one scenario I read, Kareem Daniel, now the head of this entertainment distribution group, would say, you know, we need two Marvel TV shows. I don't see a world where Kevin Feige, and I'm choosing the single most powerful individual probably as an executive in the entertainment universe, the person who runs Marvel, I'm sure he'll say, well, we'll try to do that for you.
Well, but that's already happening. Kevin Feige is already making shows for Disney Plus.
Sure, but on his schedule, when he feels they are ready for going on the service. Nobody is going to say to him, this has to be run ready by this deadline, I don't think. If he doesn't feel it's ready, it's not going.
Well, I just think that this is going to require a lot of these executives to think a little differently. I mean, look at somebody like Pete Docter at Pixar, who is running Pixar. He was just told that his movie that he directed, Soul, is not going to theaters. It's going on Disney Plus on Christmas Day. Do you think Pete Docter likes that? Do you think Pete Docter would have rather than pushed it to next summer so that he could have a proper theatrical release like most Pixar movies get and make $1 billion like most of his movies make? I'm sure he would have loved that. But he's a team player. He's running Pixar. And he said, you know what? We're sucking it up and we're putting it on Disney Plus because that's the future of the company.
You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I would agree that that's how he would feel because a lot of people are going to see this at a time when people are stuck at home and maybe he just wants them to be happy and entertained. I think he's more creative than business, but there will be a million decisions like that and we will see to what extent this thing that Disney has wrought now is a thing. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Alex Gibney is one of the most prolific documentarians working today. His credits include Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, the Scientology doc, Going Clear, which I was in, and many more. High-level corruption is one of his favorite subjects. This year, Gibney came out with a new batch of projects, among them Agents of Chaos, a two-part HBO docuseries exploring Russia's interference in U.S. politics.
For some politicians in Russia and America, chaos isn't something to fear. It's just part of the game. It doesn't matter how you play or who you play with. As long as you wind up on top, who cares if the whole system burns to the ground?
Gibney started working on Agents of Chaos for HBO in early 2017. But by early 2019, management at the channel had changed. So you start doing it with Richard Plepler, but what happens when the guard changes?
They let us continue on with the mission. so we kept going where we had started. And what Richard had done was to say, start investigating and then see where you get to. And, you know, in conjunction with Lowell Bergman, we were doing a good bunch of investigating. We had some very interesting independent journalists from Russia we were working with also. And we were traveling to Russia and to Ukraine and finding a lot of stuff out, and we got better and better material. And over time, HBO had enough confidence in what we had uncovered that they gave us the territory to do a two-part, four-hour miniseries, which ultimately aired on HBO in September.
So you had already been mucking about in Russia before. And maybe I have this wrong, but you can correct me. Does Agents of Chaos somewhat start with Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS coming to you? And just to try to set the table for that, he is a guy who had started looking into Trump Russia at the behest, weirdly, of Marco Rubio, and then switched clients, but continued to. And all this ultimately generated what has come to be known as the Steele dossier, which has been the subject of unending controversy. That approach to you, he tells you he thinks that he thinks the Russians could potentially try to kill him.
He's nervous. Let's just put it that way. He's nervous. I mean, I got a call to come out and interview somebody, and I was not told exactly who it was, but I was told it would be extremely interesting and related to all things Trump and Russia. So on that basis, I went out to California from New York and ended up shooting an interview with Glenn Simpson. And Glenn kind of wanted to put on record at the time what he knew in case something happened to him or he was compromised in some way. He wanted to lay it all out there. And so that's what he did. And that started the beginning of our investigation.
So when you hear that, do you think, oh, come on, dude, you're not, no, Russia's not killing you? Or do you think, I've been to Russia, maybe Russia is killing you?
You know, as it happened, I hadn't yet been to Russia. I mean, I had been there a number of times for other reasons, but I hadn't done any of my investigative work there. But you never know. In my job, you know, I like to listen, and sometimes you run across people who are paranoid. But as Hunter Thompson used to say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you don't have enemies.
Right. I mean, we do know that Russia has either, we believe, killed or attempted to kill any number of people. So
there's somebody, Alexei Navalny, who was in my film about Khodorkovsky, Citizen K, who was, as we know, recently poisoned by Novichok, that nerve agent, yes, and is now recovering in Berlin.
As you went along, do you feel that the sense of danger seemed more or less plausible?
For Glenn Simpson, I had an idea of a different kind of a danger. The danger for him was not the Russians taking him out. The danger for him was endless litigation, which seems to be where he's at today. So, you know, once you become famous and outed, and that's what happened to Glenn Simpson and Fusion GPS, then suddenly you're in a different zone. You're not likely to be in physical danger, but you're likely to attract a lot of slings and arrows online and via subpoena.
Yes. So as far as getting certain interviews, I mean, I'm obviously you want everybody, I'm sure. I'm struck by somebody like Felix Sater, who is a pretty much career criminal type of person who and very Russia connected and sits for an interview with you. How do you go about approaching him and how do you deal with the fact that he's a career criminal?
Well, I mean, Lowell Bergman was the one who persuaded Felix Sater to talk, and he had him out to Berkeley, and he spoke to one of his seminars and had such a good time that he felt like he might want to explore things further. And Felix feels like he's gotten a bad rap and that, you know, the term gangster hangs over his head in an unfortunate way. And so he wanted to be able to lay out in a more candid way what he felt had happened. So he was willing to sit down, which was great. I actually found him to be a rather engaging fellow. And he taught me a lot about Trump and what Trump was doing in 2015 and 2016. In some ways, Felix is the key to understanding part two of Agents of Chaos, because you can't really understand Trump's run for presidency as a political act. It was a financial gambit. It was a way of increasing the value of his brand and in a transactional fashion of, selling a Trump Tower in Moscow, which I believe was what accounted for lots of his praising of Putin. Everybody read a lot into it in terms of what compromise is there on Donald Trump and what does this represent in terms of policy? I didn't think it had anything to do with that. I think it was everything having to do with Trump wanting to make money on that Moscow tower.
Yeah, I just have a story on Trump's relationship with NBC during the years of The Apprentice, because we have just found out, thanks to The New York Times, about how important that money from The Apprentice was to him. And there's a moment in time where he's running and he just keeps telling the network executives, I'm out by September. This is just for, why are you even getting upset about this? This is not a thing. I'll do the show. Don't worry. And then, of course, it becomes real. It's kind of dizzying what, the companies and what relates to what and who, what was funneled through where. I don't even know. I can imagine you had this sort of Russell Crowe, beautiful mind whiteboard when you were making this thing.
We did. And what the weird thing was that We kept wanting to make it more organized than it ultimately was. And that's where we ended up with the title Agents of Chaos. We had to make a film that was clear about just how crazy and chaotic this was. And really what ended up uniting stuff, to some extent, between Russia and the United States, but particularly in the United States, was just a craven desire for money and using the political process to make money. And that's where, you know, that's where Donald Trump is running in order to grow his brand. But that's where Paul Manafort comes in handy. You know, the one of the inventors of the favor factory in Washington, D.C., who signs on to Trump's campaign because he knows he can monetize it. And indeed does seem to cancel a rather massive debt he had to a Russian oligarch named Oleg Deripaska.
Deripaska, who is actually connects to people in Hollywood as well through a third party. So the web is really broad and can be very confusing. You get some, I think as the two Andrews, the Andrew Weissman from the Mueller Special Counsel's Office and Andrew McCabe from the FBI. I think you got them pretty late in the process. Is that right?
Both we got pretty late in the process and they ended up being critical interviews. But, you know, I had some experience with this in the past where you have to be willing to sort of upend your story when you get really good voices to come on board. And that's what we had to do. We had to completely restructure the part two in particular when the two Andrews came on. And Weissman in particular, you know, I knew Andrew Weissman from Enron because he was formerly the head of the Enron task force. His insights into all things Manafort were absolutely fascinating.
Coming up after a short break, Gibney tells us he made it his mission to finish his pandemic documentary, Totally Under Control, in time for Election Day. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters.
Have you been briefed by the CDC?
I have.
Are the words about a pandemic at this point?
No, we're not at all, and we have it totally under control. It's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
This clip from a CNBC interview with Donald Trump in January gave director Alex Gibney the title of his new documentary, Totally Under Control. Of course, things were hardly under control. Gibney's film tracks the administration's bungled response to the pandemic, which sadly rages on. Gibney and his two co-directors did much of the work on the project in secret. Some was shot in person and some remotely, using a special rig for those who weren't comfortable having filmmakers enter their space. Gibney was finishing up his series on Russian election interference earlier this year, and by his own admission, shouldn't have jumped into Totally Under Control. At what point do you say, I know, I'm doing this thing called Agents of Chaos, which is completely chaotic, but let's do this too at the same time during a pandemic?
Yes, it was insane, absolutely insane for me to even consider it. But suddenly we're in the midst of a pandemic. I'm doing all my editing remotely, on Agents of Chaos. I had no business doing it, but, you know, I lost a friend to COVID. Another friend of mine, you know, was on a ventilator for 2 weeks. And I was just gobsmacked by the completely incompetent federal response to the pandemic. And I just thought something needs to be done. Something needs to be said that will reckon with this and reckon with this on a really accelerated schedule, which was sensible in terms of public discourse, but completely insane in terms of my own schedule. So I reached out to two colleagues, Ophelia Harutunian, who had produced a film of mine called Crazy Not Insane, which has yet to come out, and also been, you know, she speaks Russian and she had been on board as an associate producer on Citizen K, and Suzanne Hillinger, who I hadn't worked with before, but I knew, and she had also some hard news experience in addition to feature doc experience. So I felt that together, the three of us could produce and direct it together, that might give the film a shot of being properly completed. And so that's what we did. It was absolutely crazy of me to take it on, but I felt necessary.
How did you go about getting it financed?
I went, the first thing that I did was to find a distributor, because I thought if I find a distributor who's willing to put it out, then I can, you know, execute my plan. So I went to my friend Tom Quinn at Neon and said, if we can make this film in time and do a rigorous investigation into the early days of the federal response, will you put it out in early October? And he said, yes.
You know, he didn't say how much will that cost?
Well, he didn't end up paying. So, you know, he was the distributor, which allowed me to say to investors, if you build it, we will come, or something like that. In other words, we have distribution mechanism. So if you invest in this, you know it's going to be on, and you know it's going to be on at a time it's going to make an impact. Will you come on board? And a number of investors came on board at that point, including Jeffrey Lurie, who's one of the executive producers. He's the owner of the Philadelphia Eagles. The participant came on board, a colleague named Mike Baird, another gentleman named Mark Lampert. You know, they all had companies that do invest in projects like this. And they came on board, and God bless them, they came on board on the basis of a very slender précis of an idea, but just the sense that we were going to dig in and we were going to have it out in time for people to reckon with it before the election.
Now, you devised a rig so you could interview people in either in person with like a shower curtain where your camera people were behind and your producers, I guess, or co-directors. And then you had another remote version.
We did. We had two rigs, depending on the comfort level of the interview subject. And one was called the COVID Cam, which was invented by... we could call it the Ben Cam. It was invented by Ben Bloodwell. It was basically a tray with a handle on which was mounted a computer, a DSLR, and a microphone. And what would happen is we'd send it to the city where, you know, the interview subject was. We get a local AC to get it and bring it to the front porch of the interview subject, connect to their internet. And then we would turn on the device and then that AC would leave, sort of sit in a car nearby.
By AC, you mean the camera person.
And then the subject would come pick it up. And from that moment, Ben would have eyes literally on the subject and could operate remotely. We did a number of them that way. Two of them ended up in the film. And then the other way was to kind of set up in an Airbnb near the interview subject. And the either Ben or another camera person, and it was always just one person, would go in way early, kind of scrub down the place, set up this sort of shower curtain tarp barrier between the subject and the camera, only, you know, perforated by a hole for the lens. And on top of the lens would be a kind of teleprompter onto which would be projected the image of whoever was doing the interview. That's how we did that one. And there's also a fun kind of hop on that ball, because we used iPhones to kind of give a sense of what these setups looked like, because we thought it was interesting seeing people come into these sets, take off their masks, get comfortable. But we filmed the setup with iPhones, and we did that also in South Korea where we filmed. But in South Korea, because they had done so much better than we had in terms of, you know, response to COVID, they had a crew of four or five people, all of whom were mostly unmasked and
unbelievable,
going about their business. And you can see they had the barrier too, but, you know, it wasn't such a big deal there because they were mostly already out of the woods. Very few people had the disease.
It makes you want to sob.
It does.
So I think, you know, Rick Bright from NIH, the whistleblower who recently has just left his position because of being tormented, he was an important subject for you to get. And the other one was Max Kennedy, who was in the room with the Jared Kushner task force. And I use the words task force very loosely in this case. So I did. Was it easier to get Rick Bright because he's a whistleblower, or were there problems with that too?
It was tough. It was tough getting Rick. I mean, it was tough getting anybody from inside. And, you know, for obvious reasons with people who were still there. And Rick, actually, when we were reaching out to him, had been kind of pushed out of BARDA, which was the agency he was running, you know, that was in charge of, you know, public-private pandemic response, into NIH as a result of his whistleblowing. So he was still in the government. And he had, you know, given a whistleblower statement to Congress and testified before Congress and given a short interview to 60 Minutes, but then had stopped talking. So it took some persuading to get Rick to come on board and give a kind of full testimony. But he ultimately did sit down for a good, I think it was 4 or 5 hours, to really give a full debrief of what he saw inside the administration, which was hugely helpful.
How did you turn it around with him?
I think at the end of the day, it was just making him comfortable that we were going to do a good job of presenting the facts, that it wasn't, you know, that it was really going to be rigorous and that it was going to be truthful. And he went and looked at some of my previous films through another journalist I had a relationship with. You know, I had a certain connection in common with his lawyer, you know, who's very talented lawyer and good at wrestling with whistleblower problems.
Do you have any sense that Totally Under Control is going to be have an impact in terms of the election? I mean, because you did make a point of having it out before.
I hope so. And I think it will. I mean, the trailer dropped, weirdly, the same day that Trump declared positive for COVID.
Oh, yes. That must have been the shocker. I know you put in a card at the end saying that.
And the card says the day after we finished this movie, Trump declared positive for coronavirus. I got a call at 2 a.m. in the morning from Tom Quinn at Neon. You know, and at the moment I was sleeping soundly, but it's never a good thing when you get a call at 2 a.m. It's usually bad news. And he was saying, well, Trump has declared positive. And I didn't sleep for the rest of the night because I was thinking, how are we going to, you know, tear apart the movie and put it back together again? Ultimately, we decided it was kind of a card was sort of haiku-like poetry for the ending rather than, you know, upending what we had done. It made sense to do it that way, but it did give me a lot of anxiety, at least for a moment.
It's one of those things where the drama, you just have to say, this is the movie and we're putting it out there and we can do another movie if we need to, want to, or a podcast. I have no doubt, Alex, knowing you, that you're already doing things that you're not telling me about.
I am, yes.
Okay. Alex Gibney is the co-director of Totally Under Control, now available on demand, as well as the filmmaker behind the HBO documentary Agents of Chaos. Thank you so much, Alex. I know you're busy.
Thank you, Kim.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program with help from Desmond Taylor and Mario Diaz. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. KCRW's Power in Numbers membership drive is underway. If you have the means right now, please support KCRW, a public resource for all. Member benefits include chats with our hosts and DJs, perks at KCRW events, limited edition merch, discounts at local shops, and more. To make a donation, go to kcrw.com/gib, and thank you very much. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.